week with Bible studies by Fred Geiser, again, professor of Old Testament at Luther Seminary. So let's say thanks to Fred for leading us in Bible study this morning.
Thanks, Eric. I was looking for a different text. It'll start all over again for Bible study. But I don't see it at the moment. But there's that lovely line in Hosea about God being a tearing bear. So, if you get eaten, it's all part of the image of God. Thanks. Happy to be here. Holy Trinity, stay after. Not that one, those. Foolishness of God is the theme. When I was told that, it seemed clear to me that as an Old Testament teacher, the texts I have to look at are the texts from the latter part of the book of Isaiah. Now, it helps, of course, that that's the course I teach most often, so I could probably make that work with anything, but it does work remarkably well with this theme because it is the time, the second half of the book of Isaiah, in the exile and after, when the people of God, all is lost, all is broken, all is destroyed, and the task of the prophet is to recreate everything, reshape everything, renew everything. And in the process, all of the old traditions which are picked up get reshaped, retwisted, skewed, and made new in a way that is in some sense foolish in itself. Why, how can you get away with that? But then also in the process, reimagines, redefines, re-identifies God in ways that to our expectations might seem remarkably foolish as well. So those are the texts that some of those texts I will be looking at. Given the, I'm not sure my students at Luther Seminary would regard coming to Isaiah class as part of the break from work, but given the time, I suppose I should hold questions, and I'll mill around afterwards or during the day. If you have stuff you want to talk about, feel free to do that. The opening text of the second part of the book is one we know many of us, most of us, remarkably well. It's one of those texts that you know so well that it's hard to teach because we already know what it means. And for any of you who have sung Messiah, you not only know the words, you know the tune. And when that's the case, then it's impossible to beat that out of your head and say, which I finally don't want to do, but on the other hand, even to the extent of saying, well, let's back up a moment and examine the text in its native habitat before we hear it as part of an Advent Christmas oratorio. But there's the text. Many of you will know it. Comfort, O comfort, my people, says your God. This is the opening text to what we now call, what I called in the description of this course, the latter day Isaiah, the second part of the book of Isaiah. Comfort, O comfort, my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries out, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. Then the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all people shall see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. a voice says, "Cry out." And I said, "What shall I cry? All people are grass. Their constancy is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. Get you up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good tidings. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good tidings. Lift it up, do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. See, the Lord comes with might, and his arm rules for him. His reward is with him, and his recompense before him. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms and carry them in his bosom and gently lead the mother sheep." That's the text. Now, background a moment. More of the background a moment. To reiterate, all is lost. We cannot overemphasize that observation. God comes to Israel and promises all kinds of things. Great nation, lost. Population gone. Land gone. Temple, Zion, Jerusalem, inviolable forever. Nobody can come to this place. Gone. David, Messiah, always a messianic ruler on the throne of David. Gone. So the question for the people is obvious and real and way too terrifying. Namely, that stuff we talked about last night, I will be your people and you will be my God. Is the covenant gone too? I mean, all the promises seem gone. That's what gives rise to the poignancy and the fierce anger that we hear, for example, in Psalm 137. That's that awful one that starts out so tender and poignant. How do you sing the Lord's song in a strange land, namely Babylon? How do you do that when I'm forcibly transplanted? I mean, it would be like the Nazis in Auschwitz taunting the Jews to sing a nice song for us. How do you do that in that situation? And out of that poignancy then comes also the fierce anger that we remember from the end of Psalm 137, which is why we never sing it in church. Da, 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 da. I mean, you can't do that to happy shall be they who take your little ones and dash them against the rock. Blessed are those who beat your baby's brains out. Don't sing that a lot in church, as the last line of Psalm 137. But this is the situation that gives rise to it, and we can understand something more of the situation if, in fact, we read the Book of Lamentations, which are the poems of lament, of sadness, of weeping, of precisely these people over the destruction of Jerusalem and the hauling off of the people into exile. Destruction of a major city in the ancient world was not a pretty event. You got no gunpowder. How do you conquer and be a major walled city? The primary method is starvation, right? You blockade the city and starve them out. Well, that can take years in a large city, and it's not a pretty thing to watch. So, Lamentations, the tongue of the infant sticks to the roof of its mouth for thirst. The children beg for food, but no one... And then it gets worse. The hands of compassionate women have boiled their own children. They became their food in the destruction of my people. Look, O Lord, and consider, to whom have you done this? Should women eat their offspring, the children they have borne? it doesn't get any worse than that, right? We're not talking about active cannibalism, living cannibalism here, but we are undoubtedly talking about, you know, the mother who has many mouths to feed of children, and the baby has just died, and there's nothing else to eat. What do you feed the rest of the kids? Can you imagine anything worse than that? And in that situation, you can perhaps begin to imagine then the fierce anger that says, happy shall be he, they, Babylon, who beat your little baby's brains out. Because it's what has happened to us. That's the situation in which our book arises. A few other lines from there to set the tone. I mean, the book ends with the terrible possibility that it may be all over. The last lines of Lamentations. But you, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures to all generations. Why have you forgotten us completely? Why have you forsaken us these many days? Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless, last line, unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure. Last line of the book. It might be all over. That's the situation. And in that situation, several other lines from the book, how lonely sits the city that once was full of people. How like a widow she has become, she that was great among the nations. She weeps bitterly in the night. This is Jerusalem. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, those are the other gods when they didn't do what they were supposed to do last night. Among all her lovers, she has no one to comfort her. Her downfall was appalling. These are several verses from the first chapter. Her downfall was appalling with none to comfort her. For these things I weep, my eyes flow with tears, for a comforter is far from me, one to revive my courage. Zion stretches out her hands, but there is no one to comfort her. They heard how I was groaning, with no one to comfort me. Hear that refrain? Hear the prophet? Comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her. Get the translation right, that she has served her term. Comfort, O comfort, no one to comfort. Now there is. By no means accidental. I don't think for an instant this is accidental. The prophet deliberately picks up the refrain from Lamentations. God deliberately picks up the refrain from Lamentations and comes back with this word of comfort to the people of Jerusalem. No one to comfort unless there is. But can we believe it? Can we accept it? We're still in terror here. We're still nowhere here. We're still in Auschwitz here. We're still in Babylonian captivity here when this word is spoken. So some guy gets up and says, hey, it's okay. Yeah, well, it's going to take a lot of convincing to make that work. Comfort, oh, comfort my people, says your God. The language is intriguing in all kinds of ways, and we could come back and go through it at great detail in another setting. But speak tenderly to Jerusalem. The Hebrew there is speak to the heart of Jerusalem. Alev, speak to the heart of Jerusalem. And if you look it up in your handy-dandy concordance somewhere, you'll find that it is primarily used for lovers. Ruth, Boaz, speak tenderly, speak to the heart. Here comes God speaking not only comfort, but speaking as lover to Israel in a way that begins to express the radicality of what God's going to have to be up to win these people's hearts anew, to woo them back, to make them understand who God is in remarkably new ways. And we will find throughout the material through this chapter that this incredible intimacy of the language, this is where the line comes from. Now, what am I going to say tomorrow? But this is where the line comes from that I used last night in the sermon also. You are honored, precious in my sight, and honored, and I love you. Isaiah 43, remarkable intimacy. As a matter of fact, get out your handy-dandy concordance. Only place in the Bible, only place where you get the direct three-word Valentine from God. I love you. We know God's love. It's all over the place in the Bible. But I love you. It's the only place in the Bible, Isaiah 43. Remarkable intimacy. So that's the here comes the prophet with these words, with this promise, with this renewal of all things. All kinds of stuff is happening. Voices are crying out. Everything is changing. And why is everything changing? Why might it be changing? Well, guess what? Here comes God. Here is your God. Here comes God. So get you up on a high mountain. That is to say, here's the sentinels, here's the watchers on the hill, here's the people up, the bears are coming, or the fire is coming up on the fire tower, except they're up on the mountain, on the hill, on the wall, saying, "What? God is coming. The cavalry's coming over the hill. Good news." Of course, the thing is, though, and thus, of course, the comfort, same Hebrew root, is that comfort, there is no comfort in Lamentations. But of course, if we were up to inventing this scenario, it would be precisely the cavalry coming over the hill with guns, weapons, and force that like which you could not imagine. I mean, that's what we need here. That's what we want here, right? We want big God, big troops, big power, kill them babies. That's what we want. That is, that's what Israel wants. If we were in that situation, we're no better than they. It's what we would want too. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in response to the question, observation about the questions of what the heck do you do with all these prayers against the enemies in the Lament Psalms, he said, we can't do that. He says the reason we can't do that is not because we're better than they are, because we're probably worse. We like it altogether too much if we allowed ourselves to say those things. It is the spontaneous outburst of the human distress, and we can't, just because we're baptized, we are not going to remove ourselves from those spontaneous human observations. We want power here. What do we get? My point in this, in the title of this of today, what you get in Isaiah is this incredible emphasis on the divine word. Word. I mean, come on. Word. We want power. But look at the text. Help me. Count all the words in the text that relate to words, speaking or words. Count the words in the text. Help me. Comfort, oh comfort. Says first, then speak, then cry. Voice, cries. Well, I need words. Okay. Not verbs. Maybe. Okay, mouth, let's just count the direct ones, the unequivocal ones. Okay. Let me voice, cry, sad, cry. Right. Probably. Word. Herald. Lift up your voice. Herald, lift up. Say tidings. All right, you get the point. Look at that. The text is about words. It's a word text. Everything is happening here in words. Well, is that good enough? Figure out where I am in my script. If anything we suspect about the order of writing of biblical books is still true, we're a little less sanguine about that than we were once upon a time. Once upon a time, somebody published a book, this was about 30, 40 years ago, The Bible in Order, where the books are published or printed in the Bible in the order in which they were written, rather than the order in the beginning. Well, of course, you got to start there if you put them in the order of history. But what about the order in which they were written? That's clearly not going to be the same thing in the Old Testament or the New Testament. Once upon a time, we were a little more confident that we thought we knew those things. We still think we know some things. And to the degree that we think we know some things, here's the prophet writing in the midst of exile, you know, at his desk over here. And at another desk over here, guess who's writing what? Well, the priest, the guy we used to call the priestly writer, is writing Genesis 1. The material of Genesis 1, we think, not that it was invented necessarily now, but it's written down now during this same period. And what's Genesis 1 say? That will be John, but similarly. Exactly. And God speaks, and what happens? And it was. I mean, big power of the word. Big. I mean, there was nothing, and then there was. How did it get there? God spoke. That is, over here, in the same period, here's the author of Genesis 1, the writer down of Genesis 1, saying, God spoke and creation came into existence. Over here sits our prophet saying, man, if you can believe that, God speaks and meaning comes back into existence. God speaks meaning back into existence. God speaks life back into chaos. Can that work? Can that happen? I think we know it works. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. Proverbs knew that. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me. The reason we say that, of course, is because it's precisely not true. It's to ward off the truth that sticks and stones hurt for a while and names can mar my poor little psyche forever. Words do things. I do. You've done it now. Not guilty. Words do things. H. Rapp Brown in about middle 60s got up in the middle of in Detroit and said, unless things change, Detroit will burn tonight. People said, don't say that. To say it is to make it happen. Exactly. To say it is to make it happen, to set it in motion. That kind of power of the word. Words do things. You can't call them back. The jury will disregard that statement. Well, sure. Why do you think the attorney snuck it in there before the objection? Because you can't. Words cannot be called back. The pen is mightier than the sword. The power of the word, I mean, we know it all over the place. And You know, when the I love you phrase said by the significant other for the first time, wow, big words, things happen, everything changes. And here comes God. I love you, you're mine, comfort, comfort my people, speaking meaning back into existence to a for a people who had lost all. Remarkably powerful. Yet, and at the other end of our book, just to make the point, this half of the book, there's part of the book, this piece of the book, Isaiah 40 to 55, which sometimes we call Second Isaiah, is surrounded by this emphasis on the word. At the other end of it is where this other well-known text comes that we know so well. For the rain and the snow come down from heaven, water the seed, so my word will be. It's going to do things, just like the rain and the snow that water the earth. So the word does things, will not return empty, going to do things. It will accomplish my purpose. This part of the book begins and ends with this: the word of the Lord will begin forever, in chapter 40. My word will not return empty, chapter 55, kind of an inclusio, a bookends around this section of the book. It's one of the reasons we think this is a section of the book, because of this beginning and the end. And this notion of the divine word, I mean, if Lutherans didn't have these texts, we'd have to invent them. These are the biggest biblical texts we have about the power of the word and the significance and the creative life of the word. And but we wanted power. We wanted armies. We wanted cavalry coming over the hill. You get words. Come on. You get words. I mean, fine, the pen is mightier than the sword, but, you know, go talk to the bears. We probably don't want to count on it in some situations. The pen is mightier than the sword. Is there a bear whisperer in the crowd? But words, to be sure, words are powerful. But the other thing about words is, of course, they are remarkably human. Remarkably human. So God comes with a tool of great power, but a tool of remarkable humanity. And it is already here, one might say, in Isaiah, a significant sign, a significant forerunner of God's incarnation. God's going to come in words. And so John 1 is going to say, you know, in the beginning was the Word. The Word became flesh. That's what incarnation is. The Word. Words become flesh in Jesus of Nazareth. Well, you don't get more incarnate than that. There is a whole school of secular anthropology, human anthropology. Anthropology is human, isn't it? There is a whole school of secular anthropology that argues that it is the oral speech that creates what it means to be human. Oral speech is what creates exocentricity, that is, the ability to get outside oneself and to see oneself as others see us, because I can hear what I say. And so there is a sense of getting outside of myself with articulate speech that at least one school of anthropology argues that is what develops human self-consciousness. Remarkably human. Fully, totally human. God enters this thing in a word, in words. Words are powerful. They can't be taken back. But words can be refuted. Words involve dialogue. Words assume conversation. How many times, you know, between then and now, have you said, God, why don't you? If I were God, I would. And they're all power images that we want in those, in almost always. It's a power image that we want in those outbursts. Just make it work. But what if God chooses to enter the world through conversation? What in the world will that mean? God, that will mean that you're part of the conversation. That means God wants dialogue. That means God wants to get at the world in a way that does not overwhelm the human that God has created, but that wants to bring the human that God has created into the creation of meaning. Now, in some sense, it is about us, because somebody's talking to us. And to talk to us invites back talk, not necessarily sass, but conversation. Enter into the dialogue. Here's these people who have no meaning, no life, no sense of anything. And here comes God entering the world through a word that invites participation, invites conversation. Does anything matter? Does anything mean anything? Well, let's talk. That's our text. Thank you.